Welcome to The Debate. So I want you to imagine a patient in the ICU. The heart rate monitor is flashing green.
Right.
Blood pressure is stable. Oxygen is perfect. I mean, according to the dashboard, the patient is completely fine.
But in reality, their organs are, you know, quietly shutting down.
Exactly. And the material we're looking at today argues that this isn't just some rare medical anomaly. It is exactly how our global ecosystems, our governance structures, and our economies are collapsing right now.
Yeah, and it's a terrifying scenario, I agree. But let's be realistic here. Those dashboards, as imperfect as they might be, are the only reason we can even attempt to manage complex realities at scale.
Are they, though?
Well, yeah. I mean, without them, we're just guessing in the dark. We like our systems quantified, visible, and categorized because, frankly, the alternative is chaos.
But that is exactly the tension we're digging into today. We are examining the source material, the field of coherence, perception, value, and systemic alignment in complex systems. And it puts forward a really profound thesis on why complex systems experience catastrophic failure, even when they have, you know, all the data in the world.
Right, all the data, but none of the actual context.
Right. So the core disagreement we're exploring today boils down to this. When a complex system begins to fail, is the fundamental problem a lack of rigorous control and definitive proxy metrics, or is it a gradual relational decoupling where our very proxy metrics obscure the degradation of the actual system?
Yeah, and to be crystal clear on where we stand right from the outset, I contend that while the text's relational framework is conceptually elegant, abandoning definitive proxy metrics and control structures in favor of, like, distributed navigation risks fatal fragmentation in high-stakes environments. You just cannot run a power grid or a national health system on vibes and relational awareness.
Ouch. Vibes. Well, I argue that systems fail precisely due to things the text calls epistemic closure and value inversion, and therefore we're actually required to abandon top-down control in favor of responsive navigation within a relational field.
Okay, so let's get our initial positions fully on the table.
Let's do it. When I look at this material, I see a vital paradigm shift. It argues that complex systems are fundamentally relational fields. Drawing on the biology of cognition, perception is structurally conditioned.
Meaning what exactly in practice?
Meaning that no single observer, no matter how powerful their dashboard is or how high up in the hierarchy they sit, has a privileged, complete view of the system. We all just have a limited domain of what we can actually see. I see why you think that rigorous control is the answer, but let me give you a different perspective. Systems collapse when they prioritize what the text calls dashboard signals, like efficiency, throughput, economic output, over the underlying life ground conditions.
The ecological capacity, the biological resilience.
Exactly. The text defines this as value inversion.
So basically, the system looks completely healthy on paper, but it's actively dying.
Yes. A system can appear entirely coherent internally. It hits its targets, it fulfills its regulatory metrics, but it is actively consuming its own life capacity to do so. True coherence, according to the text, is an active relational alignment, not just a static achievement of metrics.
Well, look, I come at it from a different way. I acknowledge the premise that perception is distributed. I mean, it is absolutely true that no single observer has a God's eye view of a hospital system or a watershed.
Right, we're on the same page there.
We are. However, the text itself points out that divergence is the default condition of multi-agent systems. Because we all perceive partially, we naturally disagree on what's happening. If we rely purely on distributed navigation and continuous relational adjustment, we invite chaos. That is why narrative stabilization and definitive proxy metrics are absolutely essential for coordination.
But at what cost? I mean, seriously.
At the cost of nuance, yes, but the benefit is survival. When divergence is left to its own devices, it leads directly to fragmentation. Complex systems, especially in governance and large-scale infrastructure, they simply require centralized constraints and definitive indicators to function.
Even if those indicators are just illusions?
They aren't illusions, they're approximations. Yes, they filter and aggregate. But without them, you cannot coordinate action across thousands of agents. You cannot scale a system based entirely on fluid relational sense-making. The structure, the hard metrics, the reporting lines, that provides the necessary operational reality for us to act together.
Okay. I understand your point about the need for operational reality. But let's say you're right and we need these stabilizing narratives, just the function.
We do.
But the text warns us about how systems process that information, right? Moving from raw signals to the rigid narratives you're defending. Let's look at what the material calls the epistemic commons.
Right, the shared space.
Yeah, this shared space where signals circulate openly, where multiple perspectives are maintained, and crucially, where weak signals remain visible and doubt is actually permitted. The text warns us that when we prioritize narrative stabilization just to force coordination, we actively degrade this commons. We push the system into what it calls second-order distortion.
Okay, hold on. You use this term second-order distortion, but isn't that really just a fancy academic way of saying we ignored a warning sign? What makes it so fatal that it collapses an entire system?
Oh, it's much deeper than just ignoring a warning sign. First-order distortion is simply misinterpreting a signal. I mean, we all do that.
Sure.
But second-order distortion occurs when a system loses the very awareness that it is misinterpreting signals. It's a transition to epistemic closure. Think of a corporate setting where a CEO is completely obsessed with a single metric. Let's say a customer satisfaction score.
A classic trap.
Right. If frontline employees notice that the actual product is breaking down after 6 months, but the corporate survey only measures satisfaction in the first 30 days, the employees eventually just stop reporting the breakdowns.
Well, yeah, because they aren't incentivized to report them.
Worse, they may be punished for it. The narrative at the top is satisfaction is at an all-time high. So the system becomes completely blind to its own failure because it has structured its perception to only see the dashboard. Because the narrative has stabilized to coordinate action, disconfirming signals are systematically filtered out. The system starts to experience its own interpretations as self-evident reality. It treats doubt, like the employee raising a hand about product longevity, as a threat to coordination rather than a vital component of system awareness.
Right.
So the weak signals, which are the early warnings of catastrophic failure, they become completely invisible.
Look, I see the danger there. I really do. But what the text labels as epistemic closure is often just the necessary transition from signal to story. Let's look at the psychology and structural incentives of the actual actors involved. Think about the clinical bedside examples provided in the material.
Okay.
In high-pressure environments, cognitive compression is a feature, not a bug.
Explain what you mean by cognitive compression in that specific context.
It means boiling down infinite data into actionable chunks. A medical team cannot continuously debate the epistemological validity of every fluctuating vital sign while a patient is coding.
Well, obviously not.
Right. They need a stabilized narrative, like the patient is in cardiac arrest, to act collectively. If a nurse is standing there saying, well, the patient's skin temperature is slightly varied, perhaps we should maintain our epistemic commons and invite doubt.
Okay, now you're being a little uncharitable.
Am I? Because the patient dies in that scenario. If we constantly permit doubt and amplify weak signals to preserve the epistemic commons, at what point does continuous recalibration paralyze the system's ability to act? Action requires an end to debate.
It paralyzes the system only if you assume action must always be massive, definitive, and top-down. The text actually addresses this transition from signal to story. It notes that narrative reduces complexity and aligns expectations, which, yes, is useful.
Highly useful.
But the cost is that it filters incoming signals and reinterprets disconfirming evidence just to fit the story. The continuous recalibration you fear doesn't mean standing around debating philosophy while a patient codes. It means maintaining corrigibility.
Corrigibility being the ability to be corrected?
Precisely. It means when a nurse observes a subtle behavioral change that contradicts the quote-unquote stable dashboard narrative way before the patient codes, that weak signal is integrated. It's not dismissed by an attending physician who's just staring at the monitor.
Okay, but
why do nurses ignore weak signals? Because the structural hierarchy relies on the legible metric. Epistemic health is proportional to signal diversity, corrigibility, and open feedback. When you shut all that down, just for the sake of rapid action, your action is coordinated, sure, but it is effectively blind.
Blind is a strong word. I would argue it is focused. But this really is the pivot point for us. Let's say I accept your premise that our dashboards are lying to us. If we throw away the dashboard, how does a government or an institution actually do anything? We have to act, which means we have to intervene. And that brings the tension between control and navigation into sharp focus.
Right. And the text makes a crucial distinction here regarding how we intervene. Top-down control usually amplifies the distortion.
Wait, why? Why would taking control make the blindness worse?
Because of structural asymmetries. The fact that influence and access to information are totally unevenly distributed, the people at the top pulling the levers are the farthest away from the actual ground-level information.
Well, they have aggregated data.
But control assumes that the relevant features of the system are known and outcomes are predictable. And we just established that perception is distributed. Action, therefore, must be navigation.
Navigation?
Yes. Navigation means acting within a relational field while remaining deeply sensitive to feedback. It means avoiding overintervention and, most importantly, preserving optionality. In the clinical systems example, early escalation based on weak signals allows for minimal interventions that preserve the patient's physiological options. Heavy-handed reactive control usually happens after optionality has already been compressed.
That's a compelling argument, but have you considered how navigation fails in slow-moving, high-stakes environments?
Tell me.
Navigation implies steering a ship on a responsive ocean, right? But let's look at environmental infrastructure systems. They exhibit massive signal delays. It's less like steering a ship and more like adjusting the temperature in an old shower.
Ah, the old shower analogy. Let's unpack that.
Right. So you turn the dial to hot, but the water takes 30 seconds to actually reach the shower head. Because you don't feel the heat immediately, the feedback is delayed, you keep turning the dial further and further. By the time the hot water arrives, you're scalded.
Right. Standard threshold effect.
Exactly. That systemic delay is exactly why we cannot just navigate organically. If we wait for the distributed field to align its perceptions organically, we are going to scald ourselves. Doesn't the accumulation of massive structural risk demand authoritative control rather than patient, distributed navigation?
I'm not convinced by that line of reasoning, because authoritative control under conditions of delayed feedback is precisely what causes the scalding.
How do you figure?
In environmental systems, as the text outlines, signals are indeed attenuated. Nutrient loading in a watershed takes time to manifest as ecological change, right?
Yes.
If you rely on authoritative control, you are relying on a definitive proxy metric. You will not act until the metric crosses a regulatory threshold. But because of the delay, because the hot water is still in the pipes, by the time the metric definitively registers the change, the system has already lost its resilience. Optionality has been compressed.
So how does navigation solve the shower problem then?
Navigation, in this context, does not mean waiting passively for consensus. It means acting with anticipatory awareness. It means intervening early with small adjustments based on patterns of change and relational diagnostics on the ground, rather than waiting for the centralized dashboard to flash red.
It still sounds very vague.
Control demands immediate feedback from the proxy, and when the proxy is delayed, control destroys the system by overcorrecting. Control waits for certainty. Navigation responds to emerging patterns of relational decoupling.
Okay, but your anticipatory awareness still has to be operationalized. If an environmental agency is going to restrict a critical resource, say, shutting down an entire agricultural sector to prevent nutrient loading, they need definitive metrics.
Well, no, seriously. They cannot justify devastating economic interventions, ruining thousands of livelihoods, by pointing to a vague, relational decoupling or weak signals. Authority requires legible justification. You have to prove it.
And that brings us to the ultimate criteria by which we judge if a system is actually succeeding or failing. You mentioned economic interventions and livelihoods. This is where the text introduces John McMurtry's concept of the life ground. Right, the life ground.
The life ground. is the ensemble of ecological, material, bodily, and social conditions required to sustain life. The problem with the definitive metrics you're defending is shown perfectly in the text's distorted dashboard figure.
This is where the signal completely decouples from reality.
Precisely. If anyone listening has ever worked in a job where you hit all your KPIs, you got your performance bonuses, your department looked amazing on paper, but the actual company was completely falling apart, you have experienced what the author calls value inversion.
It is a very common modern experience, sadly.
Because it's a structural inevitability of proxy metrics. The upper panel of that figure shows dashboard indicators, efficiency, performance, throughput. The lower panel shows underlying conditions, ecological capacity, social cohesion, temporal resilience. Through processes of filtering, aggregation, and delay, the dashboard shows everything going up, while the underlying life ground is actively being degraded.
Everything looks great until it doesn't.
That is value inversion. The proxy metric is treated as an end in itself. True system viability is not hitting a GDP target or a hospital throughput metric. Viability is proportional to the ratio of life capacity regenerated to life capacity consumed. When a governance system exerts authoritative control to optimize a proxy, it is usually depleting the systemic margin, the very life capacity the system needs to survive.
Look, I acknowledge the danger of what McMurtry calls the ruling group mind, optimizing the wrong proxies. When a system normalizes depletion, when it decides that burning out its employees or its soil is just the cost of doing business, and stabilizes that into institutional patterns, it absolutely obscures its own degradation. I concede that point.
Okay.
However, I must challenge the operational reality of this life ground concept.
How so?
Well, if proxy metrics are inherently flawed because they filter and aggregate, how exactly does a governance system measure social capacity or life ground alignment without simply turning them into new, equally distortable proxy metrics?
Ah.
You are essentially asking institutions to govern without legibility. How do you pass a law protecting relational alignment? You can't. You have to quantify it. And the second you quantify it, you just create a new proxy.
I'm not convinced by that line of reasoning, because the text does not eliminate proxies. It isn't anti-measurement. It recognizes that indicators are completely necessary for large-scale coordination.
So we're back to dashboards?
No. The critical difference is that these proxies must remain strictly anchored to the life ground through continuous auditing of the signal-outcome alignment. And it offers a mechanism for this, the civil commons.
Right. Walk us through how the civil commons actually audits a proxy.
Sure. The civil commons consists of the institutions and practices that provide universal access to life-sustaining conditions and support the open circulation of reliable signals. Think of a robust public health system or independent environmental watchdogs.
Okay.
They act as a restorative structure. They prevent the proxy from becoming the master. Let's take the hospital throughput metric again. If throughput is the proxy, the hospital administration wants to cycle patients out of beds as fast as possible.
To keep the numbers looking good.
Exactly. But the civil commons, perhaps a union of nurses or a patient advocacy group, continuously checks that proxy against the lived reality on the ward. If patients are bouncing back into the ER 3 days later, the civil commons forces the system to acknowledge that the throughput metric is failing the life ground. By continuously checking the proxy against lived reality, you maintain signal integrity.
But the civil commons itself is subject to structural constraint and asymmetry. Let's be real about power dynamics here. The text explicitly states that governance systems are characterized by massive asymmetries of influence. Certain actors shape policy and define the flow of information.
Well, yes.
So even if you try to anchor your proxies to the life ground using a patient advocacy group or an environmental watchdog, the ruling group mind will naturally interpret the life ground in a way that aligns with its own structural incentives. The structural constraints determine what is actually possible.
So you think the watchdogs just get co-opted?
Inevitably. Therefore, you still need strong, centralized constitutional or regulatory frameworks, hard control mechanisms to force the system to prioritize life capacity.
Navigation relies way too heavily on the good faith and relational connectivity of agents who are often structurally incentivized to ignore the life ground entirely. You can't navigate your way out of a monopoly. You have to break it up with centralized authority.
I would argue that strong regulatory frameworks are a form of structural constraint, yes, but they only function if the epistemic commons is intact. If a regulatory body suffers from epistemic closure, if it only sees the dashboard provided by the monopoly, its hard control mechanisms will just forcefully optimize the wrong things. The architecture of coherence proposed in the material shows exactly how this fails. Under increasing constraint, perceptual compression leads to closure. Proxy selection displaces life ground conditions, and locally rational actions become completely misaligned. The CEO is acting rationally based on his bonus structure, but he's literally destroying the company. You cannot regulate your way out of epistemic closure with just more control.
So how do you get out of it then?
Recovery proceeds through restoring signal integrity, reopening perception, and rebuilding margin. That requires navigation. It requires lowering the cost of contradiction within the system so that weak signals, like the employee pointing out the flawed product, can actually travel upward against the gravity of structural asymmetry. You have to make it safe to challenge the dashboard.
Well, I think we're arriving at the core of our theoretical divergence. As we look to summarize, my position remains firmly grounded in the structural realities of scale. While the text's relational field beautifully diagnoses how systems become blind to their own degradation, how the transition from signal to story creates that second-order distortion, we must confront the reality of operation.
The messy reality.
Right. Complex governance and environmental infrastructure inevitably require structural stabilization. They require proxy metrics, and they require decisive, authoritative constraints to prevent catastrophic fragmentation. Divergence is intrinsic to human perception, and without the gravitational pull of centralized indicators and control, the system will just fly apart. Coherence, at scale, demands a framework that is rigidly enforced, even if we must constantly fight to keep it aligned with reality.
And I summarize my position by returning to the text's central thesis. Systemic failure is fundamentally a relational decoupling. When we rely on rigid enforcement and top-down proxy metrics, we actively degrade the system's awareness of its own health. Coherence is not a static property you can just lock in with regulations and dashboards. It is an active, daily practice.
An exhausting one, I might add.
Maybe, but a necessary one. It requires us to fiercely protect the epistemic commons, to maintain signal integrity against the immense pressures of narrative stabilization. It requires us to judge success not by the dashboard, but by the preservation of actual life capacity. Above all, it requires us to approach action as navigation, responsive, restrained, and deeply connected to the relational field, rather than relying on the blunt instrument of domination.
Well, we certainly have points of convergence. I think we both clearly see the profound danger outlined in the text regarding the degradation of feedback mechanisms. We agree that the loss of optionality, when a system has consumed all its margin to hit its KPIs and has no viable responses left, is a critical red alert early warning of system collapse.
Yes, definitely. And we clearly remain in tension over the actual mechanics of intervention. We fundamentally disagree on whether purely distributed navigation is robust enough to manage those asymmetrical power structures, and whether it can respond quickly enough to slow-moving threshold dynamics without resorting to centralized control.
Which is a tension that any practitioner, any leader, any citizen managing these systems must wrestle with daily. Aligning structural incentives with actual human and ecological life value is arguably the defining challenge of complex systems management.
Absolutely. The material provides profound diagnostic tools that warrant much deeper exploration by anyone observing or participating in complex systems. And it leaves us with a truly fascinating paradox to reflect on. The real aha moment here is that the very tools we invented to keep our system safe, our centralized metrics, our strict reporting lines, our executive dashboards, are exactly what blind us to their collapse.
It's a sobering thought.
It is. Which brings us back to where we started. When you look at the monitor in the ICU and all the lights are perfectly green, the question isn't just whether the sensors are working,
The question is, what reality has the dashboard filtered out? And are we still capable of actually seeing the patient?